This is Pro Bono Radio. Hi, I'm Waylon.
I'm Sarah. Today we have Lisa Kerr. We'll be discussing Aaron Boudreau, an important Supreme Court decision that was just released. The reason we're talking about mandatory minimums is that they are controversial and they are contested by the public because people feel it sort of handcuffs a judge into forcing a sentence they might not necessarily think is appropriate. There are a lot of principles to be considered when sentencing occurs. It is a very impactful moment at the end of what is likely a difficult trial, and it sort of sets the framework for how someone can proceed with their life after they've been convicted. And when you have these mandatory minimums, you're already pigeonholing someone regardless of any mitigating factors.
So without further ado, we'll now turn over to our interview with Professor Lisa Kerr.
I'm here today with Lisa Kerr, who teaches criminal law at Queen's University, as well as sentencing law. And today we're here to talk about a Supreme Court decision, Aaron Boudreau.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. So I was hoping we could just launch into a little bit of a brief introduction of the case, maybe going over the main topics as well as sort of what each side and the majority and the dissent said.
Sure. So this is a really fascinating decision. First, it's the first decision, the first opinion that we've received from a new justice appointed to the Supreme Court, Sheila Martin. And so everyone in the legal community was excited to see what a judgment authored by Justice Martin was going to look like. And Justice Martin authored the majority in this case. There was a dissent, and we'll talk about what the dissent was up to. But the main issue in this case was the constitutionality of what's called a mandatory victim surcharge. So what the heck is that? Well, Section 737 of the Criminal Code said that every time you're convicted of an offense, there has to be a fine that's imposed in addition to any other punishment. And so the rules are, what this provision said was that the fine should be 30% of any fine imposed, right? There'd be this extra thing sent to victims of crime. And if there was no fine imposed, then it should be a minimum of $100 for a summary offense. So those are, of course, the less serious offenses in our system, or $200 for an indictable offense. So basically what this provision did was it forced sentencing judges, even in cases that were really on the non-serious end of the spectrum, and even when they had offenders before them who were very marginalized in a socioeconomic sense, that they had to impose these fines. And we had these fines on the books for many years, but in 2013, the Harper Conservatives made a significant change. They made the fines mandatory. Before that, judges had the discretion not to impose the fine if they thought it would impose undue hardship. So, you know, for many Canadians, $100, $200 of a fine, you know, they're hardly going to notice that. It's a nominal irritation. But for highly marginalized people, people living on social assistance who might have a few hundred dollars a month to make rent and groceries and everything else, who are typically dealing with a number of challenges in life, whether it's a disability, housing precarity, that kind of thing, judges didn't want to add a fine to whatever punishment those folks were getting from the courts, partly because judges knew they weren't going to get the money, right? It was just going to set up a sort of administrative hassle that would burden the court system and would burden the individual sort of unduly, right? And so in 2013, Harper Conservatives passed this law, and it has, you know, they had all these very fancy names for their laws that were all about sort of marketing to Canadians what they were up to. So the bill was called Increasing Offenders Accountability for Victims Act. You know, sounds like a good title. Who would be against that? But what it did was it made the imposition of this fine mandatory, even in cases where it really made no sense. And so lower court judges were pretty irritated by this, and they were trying to avoid it, and they declared it unconstitutional, and there was all these cases going on. And so that's a long way of saying that's the background to how this issue got to the Supreme Court of Canada. And then, so what did the court do with it, right? Mm-hmm. What is the court's decision here? Well, the majority declared this mandatory victim surcharge to be unconstitutional. And what they said was that it was cruel and unusual punishment. And I know we're going to talk more about what that means.
Yes, absolutely. So before we get into Section 12 specifically, I was hoping we could go over a little bit of what are the fundamental principles of sentencing. So what is the Canadian justice system hoping for when they sentence someone?
Yeah, it's so interesting because we have this sort of, I call it a menu. A lot of times, you know, statutes make really clear what judges are supposed to do and what they're supposed to consider. This isn't one of those areas where it's really clear. Instead, judges have a menu and they get to kind of order from the menu whatever they want in the context of that particular case. So on the menu, this is section 718 of the Criminal Code, are a variety of things: deterrence, denunciation, rehabilitation, providing reparation to victims, promoting responsibility, and also separation, or what's sometimes called incapacitation. So that's the sort of list. And in a particular case, a judge might order from the menu, you know, pick deterrence and sort of weigh heavily on deterrence in a particular case. Another case, a judge might lean heavily on rehabilitation. And judges aren't really told that they have to pick. They can just kind of respond to the case at hand. Now, that's subject to one bit of an exception, and that is that we do have what we typically call a fundamental principle, which is section 718.1 of the code, which says a sentence must be, so this is mandatory language, proportionate to the gravity of the offense and the degree of responsibility of the offender. So judges are allowed to pick rehabilitation, pick deterrence, pick these other things, but they can never, according to the code, impose a sentence that is disproportionate to the gravity of the offense. So how serious the offense was and how responsible this offender is. And so when we're looking at those questions, gravity and responsibility, we look at, typically in the case law, we talk about the circumstances of the offense and the circumstances of the offender. And part of what's at issue in Boudreau is that sentencing judges weren't able to respond to the circumstances of some offenders, those highly socioeconomically marginalized offenders for whom this fine was unpayable and would wind up, you know, generating an indefinite sentence. So that's kind of like how this case was interacting with the principles of sentencing that are set out in the code. Mm-hmm.
So part of the argument in this was that Section 737 is unconstitutional because it violates Section 12 of the Charter. And I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about Section 12 and cruel and unusual punishment and what that means and how it plays into Boudreau in this case.
For sure. So Section 12, as you say, Sarah, is about a prohibition on the state imposing cruel and unusual punishment. And that's language that goes back to the Magna Carta, and it shows up in the U.S. Constitution under the Eighth Amendment as well. So it's a pretty standard kind of prohibition in sort of constitutional democracies like ours. But as usual with constitutional law, it's all about what does the court say that means, right? What does this phrase cruel and unusual punishment actually mean? And in the, you know, typically since we got the Charter in 1982, most courts have said that this is going to be pretty hard to show. This is a high bar. What it's going to take is not just a disproportionate sentence, not a sentence that's a little bit too much, right? Not a merely excessive sentence, as is said in the case law, but a sentence that is so excessive that it outrages standards of decency. So it's some really sort of high language here. The sentence has to be abhorrent, intolerable, incompatible with human dignity. So really with those phrases, the court has suggested that the judiciary in Canada is going to leave a lot of space to Parliament, right? Leave a lot of discretion to Parliament to decide for itself what sentences are going to be. The courts aren't going to strike down just any disproportionate sentence. Having said that, we've seen the Supreme Court of Canada strike down three mandatory punishments before Boudreau, three mandatory terms of incarceration, a case called Smith in 1987, a case called, I shouldn't have said the years because now I can't remember exactly the years. I think Nur is something like 2010 and I think Lloyd is something like 2013, somewhere around there. And so only three times has the court said that a prison sentence, a length of time that someone has to spend in prison, is grossly disproportionate. It's cruel and unusual. Has to be declared invalid under Section 12. Only three times. But in recent years, we've seen dozens and dozens of lower courts striking down mandatory minimum sentences all over the place. So, you know, the liberals have passed a bunch of mandatory minimums in the 90s and early 2000s, and conservatives passed a ton of them between 2005 and 2015. And we're seeing those mandatory minimums get reviewed in lower courts and wind their way up, basically. As I say, only two in recent years have made it to the Supreme Court of Canada level. But we're definitely going to see more. And so here's the thing. I said it was a really high bar to show a Section 12 breach, right? This language of abhorrent and intolerable. It almost sounds like a person has to be drawn and quartered in the town square in order for the court to say this is cruel and unusual punishment, right? Something medieval, something corporal and barbaric. But what we're actually seeing is contemporary Canadian courts in both the Supreme Court and in lower courts are striking down even what we might think of as shorter terms of incarceration, even things like 90 days, and even for very serious offenses like possession of child pornography, accessing child pornography, and other crimes that do involve a bodily integrity element as well. So we're seeing the courts, even though they say the bar is high, they seem fairly willing, at least in recent years, to say that mandatory time in custody can be grossly disproportionate. Typically, it's because the circumstances of an offender are such that the courts just really don't want to send this person into custody. And so they're striking them down. So it's kind of a story of, we say it's a high bar, but in recent years, courts are much more willing to say that bar has been reached. And I think Boudreau is an example of the court affirming this language that suggests it's a high threshold, but then being very willing to look at the circumstances of the offender and find an offense, a punishment to be grossly disproportionate.
Mm-hmm. And this section and the act that implemented it comes in with what's typically seen as sort of a noble purpose. Mm. It's about the community and accountability. And in Justice Martin's decision, she mentions that while, yes, she recognizes that this is about raising funds for victim support services and increasing accountability, that it ends up causing these four interrelated harms to individuals like the offenders. And so she mentions financial consequences and the threat of incarceration, specifically being committal hearings and incarceration itself, as well as collections efforts by the province and how this can end up serving as sort of an indefinite sentence if someone is never able to pay. So I was hoping we could sort of discuss what are those harms, and obviously it was the majority decision, so they are valid harms, but sort of if you could expand a little bit on that, as well as specifically the committal hearings.
Right. Sure. So as you say, Sarah, the court was clear, and of course the dissent agrees with this as well, that this provision, 737, had a valid penal purpose. Nobody doubts that. Raising money for victims, promoting offender accountability, that's valid. Although I do have to sort of pause and note to say, you know, if governments are really serious about supporting victims, they can also allocate some of their own budget to that cause. They don't have to just sort of extract funds from offenders. So there's lots of ways for governments to show that they care about victims. And I think it would be reasonable to suggest that extracting money from criminal defendants is sort of one of the cheapest ways for the state to support that. Right. So, okay. So we can all agree that it's good to support victims. And in fact, doing so, with financial programs is probably the best way. But what really drove the court here, you know, it's interesting. If you watch the hearing, it's kind of cool. You can watch webcasts of Supreme Court hearings. So if you're interested in this case or other cases, you can go online at the Supreme Court of Canada website, look at the webcast, watch the hearing, see the arguments the lawyers get made. And I love doing this, and I love using this as a teaching tool. If you watch the hearing, one of the lawyers, a guy, James Ford, who's very good criminal defense counsel in Ottawa, he started his submissions by saying, this is a case about context. And he said, if it's not about context, it's just about $100. And then he said, green fees. And that was sort of this lawyer's way of acknowledging that for the vast majority of Canadians, and certainly everyone in this courtroom, especially those at counsel table and those sitting on the bench, the notion of $100 being cruel and unusual punishment is very hard for us to get our heads around. Because if you toss $100 down for green fees, playing golf on a Saturday afternoon, it's pretty hard to connect to what $100 fine and ongoing debt to the criminal justice system might look like in life. And so he was really, it was a great kind of way of beginning his submissions because it really acknowledged the different positions that we're all in as Canadians, what this fine would mean. And really the case is about how it's actually a pretty small number of people in Canada for whom this would be a grossly disproportionate sentence. But it's a group of people that appear with what the majority called staggering, you know, they're a staggering reality in provincial courts, right? So our provincial court system often sees people who are in really difficult circumstances. And a lot of times if there's sort of drug use and homelessness and disability issues all sort of intersecting in ways that kind of keep them criminally engaged with the criminal justice system. These are the offenders that are committing, you know, nothing more than really nuisance offenses, but who are back in front of them again and again and again, and who have a really hard time sort of navigating the system, finishing their sanction, finishing the proceedings, and being able to move on with their lives. And so what the majority said was, you know, adding this fine and adding the prospect of continual committal hearings really just made things more difficult for these people and really more burdensome for the criminal justice system. And so part of the reality here, as you mentioned, these few factors that the court looked at, the reality was that, you know, the provision said if someone's unable to pay, then you can't incarcerate them for failing to pay. Mm-hmm. You could incarcerate them if a judge found that they could pay and are just deciding not to. But for those who were unable to pay, they couldn't be incarcerated. And so the dissent really focused on that and said, well, how is this so bad if you just go in front of the judge and you say, I can't pay? And you can get the provision allows extensions of time. There's no limits on how long the time can be extended for. So the dissent really focused on there are, you know, it's not as draconian a scheme as you might think, right? What the majority said was the reality is that for folks who have to go repeatedly in front of a judge and say, I can't pay, I need an extension, even that was going to be onerous for them. And the reality was that once you receive a summons, right, to attend one of these hearings, you know, if you fail to respond to that summons, and many people who are like not able to really manage their legal affairs or who maybe aren't receiving mail because they don't have a home, right, that can generate a warrant of committal if they fail to respond to one of those summons. Once that warrant issues, courts really have no power to modify, to take into circumstances. So at that point, the offender really is at risk of being taken to jail, and will have to serve time to discharge their obligation. So that's just kind of one example of how, even though the rule was you're not supposed to face incarceration for not being able to pay, the realities for this group of offenders was that they did face ongoing risks of detention and incarceration as a result. And that's even, of course, where an offender is unable to pay for reasons rooted in mental illness or physical disability, age, right? These hearings were going to continue. They weren't going to discharge this debt. I mean, we're really in the kinds of offenders the court was thinking about. I mean, one example is a case called Michael. The court talked about a guy who's 26 years old, who's all kinds of addiction issues, who's homeless, and who has what's called a street allowance, a sort of social welfare payment of $250 a month. So that's what he had in his pocket each month. And he committed a number of nuisance offenses and got $900 in the victim surcharge fine. because the court has to impose $100 for every single summary conviction offense. So for some, this would wind up being in the hundreds and the thousands. Now, for this guy in this case called Michael, he was never going to pay that $900 fee. That was never happening. And because of the realities of how you have to continue to show up and explain to the court that you can't pay, it was unlikely that he was going to be able to do that successfully on an ongoing basis. So he really did face a risk of detention. And he really did face a risk of this fine being sort of an indeterminate sanction.
Mm-hmm. And that leads us nicely into the next discussion point, which is part of this judgment discussed the reasonable hypothetical offender. But Justice Martin pointed out that in this case, the plaintiffs are not hypothetical. They are real people. She said, specifically talking about the case of Michael, without a doubt, offenders with some or all of these characteristics appear with staggering regularity in our provincial courts. Given this reality, referring to hypotheticals in this case is somewhat of a misnomer. The reasonable hypothetical offender urged on this court is Mr. Michael, not a fabrication, but a real person. And what I'd like to hear from you is, how does this reflect the way the Canadian justice system views sentencing? A lot of the time it is discussed as being individualized, but the whole idea of the reasonable hypothetical offender is not individualized.
Yeah, so it's a great question. It's such a curious little device, the reasonable hypothetical offender. We got to do a little bit of history on where it came from, because usually in our system, in the legal system, if you're going to go to court and ask them to do something for you, you have to ask the judge to do it on the basis of the evidence that you adduce. And it's usually your experience, right? There might be some expert evidence you bring in, but it's really, you know, you're asking for your case to be adjudicated. And with this reasonable hypothetical device, a plaintiff or a litigant is allowed to ask the court to imagine someone and to declare something unconstitutional on the basis of an imagined figure. Now, it has to be realistic and so on. You're not allowed to like imagine some fanciful, far-fetched thing, but still it's unusual. And so it goes right back to this first case under Section 12, which is a case called Smith in 1987. And in Smith, you had this guy challenging a mandatory sentence that we had in place at the time that was a seven-year prison sentence for any kind of importing of a narcotic. So no matter how you imported your narcotic, you were going for 7 years to a federal penitentiary. And, you know, for Canada, that's a pretty long sentence, especially for a drug offense. And then if you add to that, what if it's a first-time offender? What if it's a guy who brought over a single joint or a marijuana cigarette, as we say in the case law, or old people say, like myself? So this seven-year mandatory applied no matter who the offender was, what their record was, how this offense was committed, how serious this was. And that was what was at issue before the court. And so the court said, this is crazy. You know, there will be cases where this generates a grossly disproportionate, unacceptable, abhorrent, intolerable sentence. We shouldn't send a first-time offender who brings a joint over the border into a federal prison for 7 years. And what was interesting is that in that particular case, Mr. Smith, the litigant, he conceded that 7 years was an okay sentence for him. I don't know exactly his situation, but I take it he had a record and had brought in much more than a single joint. But because the court was concerned with just leaving that sentence on the books, right? The court was concerned with that. The court didn't want to leave what was clearly a law that would have unconstitutional application in at least some cases, cases that weren't that hard to imagine. They didn't want to leave it on the books. And so they declared it unconstitutional, but on the basis not of Mr. Smith's circumstance, but of the reasonable hypothetical offender. And part of the court's not explicit about this in Smith, but I think part of the concern in this area is that the realities of plea bargaining are such that the presence of a mandatory minimum on the books can impact plea bargaining. So if the Crown prosecutor could charge you with an offense that where there's a mandatory attached, And that's a 7 year. So let's say 7 year mandatory. And the Crown comes into a plea negotiation and says, don't worry, I'm not going to charge you with that. You just need to plead guilty to this less serious offense. Even if you feel you are innocent or that you have a defense to that less serious offense, you're going to probably plead guilty because you're freaked out about the risk of that 7 year. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think part of the concern here is if you leave these big mandatories that could be unconstitutional in some cases on the books, they can kind of be dysfunctional in the plea bargaining context. And I'm not suggesting Crown attorneys, you know, threaten you with those, which would be most improper.
Of course.
In fact, Justice Muldaver in a case called Nur said that would be an abusive process. But it is still part of the reality of what an offender might be or someone accused of an offense might be worried about in the plea bargaining context. So that's where the hypothetical offender comes from. And it's interesting. These three cases I mentioned, Smith, of course, Nur and Lloyd, where the Supreme Court struck down a mandatory, all of those were based on a reasonable hypothetical. In each of those cases, the litigant in the case at bar conceded, hey, for me, this sentence makes sense. but for someone else, for someone with less of a record, for someone who committed this offense in a less culpable way, and the court accepted that. Now, recently, we're seeing the lower courts have kind of stopped resorting to the reasonable hypothetical. They're really focusing more on the case, on the offender in the cases at bar. And it might be just that we've had this proliferation of mandatories. So there's just so many people, you know, affected by them in situations where they're really, you know, unjust or excessive. And so lately we've kind of seen this move away from the reasonable hypothetical, but you're perfectly right, Sarah, to say that in this case, so this was a case where there was a bunch of appeals joined together. So it's not just Mr. Boudreau, but a few other offenders who were part of this case. And there were seven of them coming from Ontario and Quebec. And four of the seven said that this sentence was grossly disproportionate in their own case. And so the court was thinking about four real situations. And then the court also pointed to, what was technically a reasonable hypothetical, but it was actually just an offender named Michael in a case called Michael. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's right to say that a real offender in a real case, isn't that just called referring to the common law rather than a reasonable hypothetical? So it's an interesting sort of history there.
So branching off of that with the sort of individualized nature of it, one of the aspects raised in this case was that the court said that this surcharge eliminates the judge's ability to consider mitigating factors. So before we sort of get into that,
right.
I was hoping you could give us a little overview of, you know, what are mitigating factors and why are they important? Why should they play an important role in sentencing?
Right. That's a great question. So I think it's really important to know that in Canada, unless there's a mandatory minimum that applies, and I've already talked about, you know, how those are going down in flames right now. In most cases, every case where there's no mandatory, judges in our system have a lot of discretion, right? That's just part of our system. We trust judges in this country, and we have appellate review over sentencing decisions as well. So to the extent we don't trust judges, we trust that appeal courts will fix any decisions of lower courts that are sort of outside the bounds. And so we give judges a lot of discretion. And part of that discretion is to look in a very, as you say, individualized way at the circumstances of the offender, along with, of course, the features of the offense and these other concerns. And so, and we haven't really had a lot of limits on what can be considered, in mitigation, right? So the mitigating factors that can be considered. So in our system, Let's think about the sort of standard mitigating facts in terms of the circumstances of the offender. If someone is raised in, if they're raised in care, they're raised in state care, they're not raised with their own parents. If they're raised without the ability to complete their education. If they're raised in, you know, relatedly socioeconomic disadvantage. If they experienced abuse in their childhood homes. if they don't have a criminal record, if they have contributed to their communities in positive ways, although there's some limits on that because you have to be a bit careful about just awarding people who've had social advantages and are therefore able to do volunteer work and so on. So we do, we look carefully at the life of an offender. And, you know, we look at this kind of information in what's called pre-sentence reports. And that's for all offenders. And of course, if you're dealing with an Indigenous offender, then, we consider that information through a GLADUE report. But our system, you know, we are, at least so far, this could change, deeply committed to the idea that we should think about who this person is, where they came from, and whether, what kinds of opportunities they did and did not have in order to avoid, engagement, involvement with the criminal justice system. Now, our system could be different, and maybe one day we'll have some kind of sentencing reform revolution. The U.S. had one of those in the 1980s, and in the federal system from about 1985 to 2005, all that stuff I just mentioned, they basically, Congress abolished it and said, judges shouldn't think about any of that stuff anymore. All the stuff that our judges think is central, they said, no, don't think about addiction, don't think about socioeconomic disadvantage. Don't think about any of those things that have to do with the individual. Look at the offense and look at their record. And that was really this experiment with the U.S. federal sentencing guidelines, which happened over those few decades. You know, that was the system they moved to with an extraordinary impact, I should say, on their rate of incarceration. It went way up federally during those years. And so, yeah, today, right now, we have a system that's very individualized, it's all about proportionality. We have almost no limits on what can be considered in mitigation. Of course, we also look at aggravating factors, mm-hmm. right? We look at that too, of course. Aggravating factors often flow from features of the offense. Like, for example, an assault that's accompanied by a racial slur is more serious than an assault that is not accompanied by a racial slur. So we look at those things and we say that deserves a more serious sentence. That doesn't. If someone had every advantage in life, enjoyed a position of privilege and power, and abused that position, that's a circumstance of the offender that can be aggravating in sentence, right? If people are very young, that can be mitigating. So, I mean, it's a very, in Canada, it's a very individualized, very discretionary proceeding. Personally, I think that's good. I think that to do justice means to try and in a serious way to encounter the individual before the court and to acknowledge that, you know, it's kind of like there's a morality involved in trying to acknowledge that we all come from different places and that we've all had different kinds of opportunities and that it's simply on a moral level does not make sense to treat an offender as if they committed the same moral wrong as someone who did not face anything resembling the adversity that they faced. And that's, you know, we know sort of how criminal trajectories work and how much your childhood and those opportunities matter to a criminal trajectory. And so I think it's perfectly proper and, in fact, morally required that we have a sentencing system that resembles the one we have.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's absolutely fascinating to think about and yeah. think about how it's been shaped and how sentencing is shaped.
Right.
And so in light of Provision 737 now being struck down,
yeah.
do you think Parliament may respond in the future and perhaps attempt to redraft something along those lines? We've seen that before, right. obviously, in history, where the SCC makes a decision and Parliament decides to change it.
We call that judicial dialogue. the dialogue theory. Perfectly appropriate. Mm-hmm. Listen, on this particular issue, I mean, you're referring, of course, to the Bedford case, which struck down the prostitution provisions, and then we saw the conservatives redraft those provisions.
Of course.
But with some different purposes and some different features, like just enough. This isn't the same. And of course, we saw that as well in the wake of the Carter decision, which struck down the criminal prohibition on medically assisted dying. And we saw a liberal response that, you know, did sort of honor that decriminalization, but added some extra features to some hoops you had to jump through in order to be able to access it that weren't in the court decision. I don't want to suggest the legislative response to Carter is similar to the one to Bedford. I think the Bedford one is a little bit more, you know, not in the spirit of the Supreme Court's decision. Those are big policy issues, right? Decriminalizing prostitution, decriminalizing physician-assisted dying. Those cases, it sort of makes sense that the parliamentary response was sort of complex and had multiple parts, and it requires lots of serious thinkers and lawyers and judges to analyze whether the response abides by the letter and spirit of the constitutional ruling. So that's a complicated thing. Boudreaux is a lot more simple than that. I think it's fair to say that you cannot have a mandatory fine that judges have to impose in addition to another sentence. I think that it would be if Parliament passed another provision like that, it'd be a pretty straightforward path to getting that struck down on the basis of stare decisis. So I don't expect that government will do that, because I think they, even if we elected, let's say, government that really wanted to capitalize on criminal justice policy, wanted to sort of politicize it, wanted to be like a victim rights, tough on crime government. This is not too hard to imagine given recent Canadian experience. Even if we elected a government like that again, I think that if they proposed a bill like that, they would receive very swift and clear advice from the civil service that that's not a charter compliant bill. And if they went ahead and passed it anyways, which has also happened in recent Canadian memory, I think it would be a pretty short path to getting that struck down. But more interesting question, a bigger question, which I think you're also asking, is, you know, what is the sort of general precedential value of this decision?
Absolutely.
Right? And that was something the dissent was worried about, right? The dissent was worried, and this came up in the hearing as well, that this might mean that any time there's a mandatory fine, it could be unconstitutional, because it's always going to be the case for really poor people. A fine is going to be a way bigger, you know, is a way more significant sanction than for people with more money. And there are mandatories that I think we care about in our society for impaired driving, for one, mm-hmm. That, you know, many of us, even those of us who are, you know, considered to be more, you know, on the side of protecting the rights of defendants, we might think those mandatory fines for impaired driving make sense, serve an important role. And so the dissent was worried, are all mandatory fines going to be struck down on the basis of Boudreaux? And I think no. And I say that because this surcharge was really very unique. And that's because it wasn't a surcharge that was imposed because you did a specific thing, like impaired driving. It was imposed because you committed a certain kind of offense, like a summary offense. And so if you committed 7 summary offenses, then you had $700 because it was $100 each. If you commit 1 indictable offense, then it was a $200 minimum fine. What that means, you are my criminal law student, Sarah, so I think you know what this means. If you commit murder, you're going to get a minimum $200 fine. If you commit 7 breaches of probation, you're going to get a $700 fine. That makes no sense.
Yeah, not exactly comparable or proportional in that sense either.
Exactly. So it's a really sort of untethered, you know, it's a scheme that was like untethered to moral blameworthiness. And whereas many of our other mandatory fines are there for a good reason, right? That impaired driving, we want to make sure that everyone who commits that very serious socially destructive offense pays a price for it. And so I think it would be easier under the Section 12 doctrine to justify that punishment, because the Section 12 doctrine tells us to think about the gravity of the offense. We think about the gravity of the offense when we look at it. And for that reason, many people were surprised when in the Nur case, the court struck down a firearms, a mandatory sentence for a firearm offense. Some commentators and maybe myself included thought that when it comes to guns, Canada does not like guns. And we're going to say that that's a very serious offense and a mandatory is justified. But I was wrong about that. The Supreme Court struck it down and on the basis that this particular firearms offense could be committed in a far less serious way. And the mandatory wasn't responsive to that. But when it comes to, you know, it's impossible to even analyze the gravity of the offense with the mandatory victim surcharge because it wasn't about an offense. It was just something that was tacked on to every kind of conviction that you got. So it was a really wacky scheme. And I think the dissent, you know, I can hope the dissent is comforted that I do not think the majority's reasons mean that other mandatories that are tied to specific offenses are necessarily going to be invalidated by the majority's decision.
That was my last question.
So that was a great discussion.
Thank you. And thank you for your time and your insight. And yeah, this was wonderful.
Okay.
That's it for today's episode. Pro Bono Radio is brought to you by Queen's Faculty of Law, Pro Bono Students Canada, and with the generous support of CFRC, Queen's Campus Community Radio Station, broadcasting at 101.9 FM and online at cfrc.ca. The show was written and produced by the students of Queen's Law and is intended for entertainment purposes only. We are not lawyers. Nothing contained in the episode should be considered as legal advice. If you are in need of legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Pro Bono Radio is recorded at Queen's University, situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory.